Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome in Cinema Metropole in Olomouc. It's our great pleasure to host one of the most distinguished intellectuals in the world, Professor Noam Chomsky. There are few people in the world who are as famous and as influential as Professor Chomsky, who still teaches at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Tonight we'll host a debate with him, and I have to say that Professor Chomsky is not the first important figure in the world of intellect in Olomouc. We have hosted here a couple of other very important figures like Robert Rosenstein, film historian, Benjamin Barber, political scientist, Paul Liesman, philosopher, and others. The strategy for tonight was to open up the questions for broader public, and we have got many of them through the internet. And our co-speakers today, Martin Škabraha and Vít Janeček, were about to select some of the most important interviews. Let me tell you a few words about our participants today. I think I don't need to introduce Professor Chomsky. Everybody in this hall read at least something about Professor Chomsky. Probably most of you read some of his texts on linguistics or his political commentaries. So please welcome again in Olomouc. It's really great honor for us. Second participant is Martin Škabraha, who is philosopher teaching here at Palackie University. He is also a civic activist and a member of a Green Party. Second is Vít Janeček, who is filmmaker, dramaturgist, and he's working as associate professor at Film and TV School of Academy of Performing Arts in Prague. My name is Jiří Lach, and I currently serve as a dean of Faculty of Arts. Now, let me pass a word to first speaker, to Martin Škabraha. And Martin, can I ask you to give a first question?
Thank you, and good evening, everybody. I would like to begin with a little doubt. We surely will enjoy this evening, we will enjoy this discussion, but what is the effect in the end? What can philosophers or intellectuals do against what is called the government of 1%, by 1%, and for 1%? How can philosophers and intellectuals influence politics so in such a way that it is more humanistic, more democratic, especially in this situation when politics is run by a very powerful, tiny elite? What can we do?
Well, I think, first of all, we can do exactly the same thing that carpenters and chemists and anyone else can do, namely educate ourselves, others, organize, take part in or initiate activist activism of various sorts. All of that's open to us. People who are called intellectuals are a very curious class if you think about them. So take where I teach, MIT. If there's a Nobel laureate in physics who's working 70 hours a week in his laboratory on problems of advanced physics, we don't call him an intellectual. If the janitor who cleans his room happens to have a great deal of knowledge about world affairs and a good deal of insight into human life and understanding, maybe more so than the people who write books, we don't call him an intellectual. Intellectuals are people who have a certain degree of privilege, enough to be able to reach audiences and who discuss issues of general public interest. So yes, they have given the privilege and the opportunities. They, of course, have greater responsibilities. Privilege confers responsibility. So they can do what the janitor can do or what the carpenter can do or what the chemist can do and have other opportunities too if they use them, if we want to use them. I don't think there's any shortage of opportunity. I think there are shortages of will. In fact, if you look at the history of intellectuals, it's not a pretty one. Overwhelmingly, intellectuals have labored in the service of power. The term intellectual entered modern Western usage with the Dreyfus Arts. And nowadays we respect and honor the Dreyfus Arts, the defenders of Dreyfus, critics of the French state. It certainly wasn't true at the time. They were bitterly condemned. The leading, most prominent intellectuals had denounced them, berated them for daring to criticize state power and the Holy Army and what right did these writers, painters, and so on have to talk about things they knew nothing about. The respected intellectuals, the immortals of the Académie Française, were bitterly hostile to the Dreyfus Arts. In fact, Émile Zola, the leading one, had to flee France. That's typically the pattern. And it goes back in history as far as you like. I mean, back to the earliest recorded history, there were people who were approximately what we would call intellectuals today. So in classical Greece, one of them was forced to drink the hemlock because he was corrupting the youth of Athens by asking embarrassing questions and challenging doctrine and dogma. Around the same time in the biblical record, there were people who were basically intellectuals. They're called prophets, but that's just a bad translation of a pretty obscure Hebrew word. They were people who criticized the crimes of the king, called for mercy and compassion for the poor and deprived, presented geopolitical analysis, warned of the threats that the evil kings were bringing to the people. So that's intellectuals. Now, what happened to them? They were imprisoned. They were driven into the desert. They were condemned. Centuries later, they were honored, not at the time. There were intellectuals who were honored, the flatterers at the court. Centuries later, they were called false prophets. That's pretty much the pattern. So, for example, in the West, Czech dissidents were honored, not at home, not by the ruling authorities. And conversely, intellectuals in the American domains were not only not honored, they were murdered straight out. So, for example, in a week after the fall of the Berlin Wall, in the country that was the leading recipient of U.S. military aid, aside from Israel and Egypt, a separate category, and had the worst human rights record, that's a standard correlation, El Salvador, the high command, which is in close contact with the American embassy, ordered a battalion of troops to invade the university and murder six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests, blow their brains out and kill any witnesses who happened to be around. So they also killed their housekeeper and daughter. I doubt if any of you could know their names even. But if anything like that had happened in Czechoslovakia, say, probably had a nuclear war. We'd certainly have blaring headlines about it, and you'd know their names. But that's the difference. In your own crimes, you ignore. The crimes of your enemies, you love and you admire and you praise the dissidents to the skies. Now, that's the pattern right through history. Intellectuals don't have to do that. As the fringe of dissidents, illustrates, but that's typically what they do. But apart from that, they have what they can do is what anyone else can do, and more given the relative privilege that they have.
Thank you. Good evening. I picked several questions more or less associated with education and world of, let's say, university as a general environment for keeping certain knowledge and keeping valuable things from the history till today. The memory, role of memory was always crucial in all intellectual activities and in the knowledge. And memory, the value of memory was always quite high. It was difficult to, the books were expensive, etc. I mean, also physical memory. We live in the age where the memory gets widely accessible, where basically everything can be stored and put into memory somehow. And it has also large impact for university education, starting with, I don't know, internet copy-paste system to, let's say, wide exposition of text, which people can be exposed with a text. The question is, what is your point? How, what should we keep and replicate, and what should we somehow refuse and forget within this context where the memory is so widely accessible?
Well, first of all, it's not a... I mean, what you say is correct. I mean, the access to information is much easier than it used to be. I use the internet like everyone else, and it's easier to type something into my computer and get an answer back in 30 seconds than it is to go across the street to the library and look it up. But the change from libraries to the internet is much less of a change than the change from no libraries to libraries. That was a huge change. So the internet is a slight addition and a not insignificant one. As far as information is concerned, we've always been swamped by overwhelming amounts of information. I mean, my own personal education was mostly in the, when I had a stack in the Harvard Library, and this huge resource was right there. You could walk around the library, find all kinds of things you never heard of, a huge mass of information far beyond anything that anyone could assimilate, couldn't dream of it. And the internet expands that, but not in a fundamentally different way. So I think the question has always arisen, at least since the invention of the printing press, which made information, at least in principle, available to large numbers of people. It's always the same question. You keep what's valuable and you put aside temporarily what you think may not be valuable, and it's often a mistake, and you go back and you find you made the wrong decisions. But I don't know any way out of that. That's what's done in the sciences. That's a lot of my own work, for example, has been involved in, I happen to be interested in 17th and 18th century philosophy and science, and gone back and found lots of things that were understood, very well understood, and are now being rediscovered. If they had not been forgotten, we'd be better off. If they were understood today, we'd be better off. And you never know. You can't know. You can just do your best to try. But there's no methods. We've always been swamped by information. We always have to make these difficult decisions.
Thank you, Martin.
Okay, let's develop this topic. New information or communication technologies are great opportunity, but they are very dangerous at the same time because they sort of multiply eyes and ears that our governments have, and they can spy on us more than ever in history. Sorry. Is it okay? Oh, is it? It's okay. So, as I said, there is also a very dangerous aspect to these new technologies. My question is, how can we avoid this this danger, or how can we fight against this? Because this kind of control is almost invisible, isn't it? So what can be done against this danger?
Well, I presume you're referring specifically to Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency efforts. I mean, the fact that governments spy on their enemies is not new, and nor is it new that the domestic population is one of the main enemies of just about every government and every power system. So sure, they're always going to try to spy and control their domestic enemy. Now, that goes back as far as history does. People who've been involved in activism have always been conscious of this. I mean, I was very much involved in resistance against the Vietnam War, but we never used the telephone. I assumed it's tapped. We never talked about things, sensitive things, in open meetings. They're probably infiltrators, sure, and that goes on all the time. But the scale of President Obama's efforts was really a shock. There's never been anything remotely like that. I mean, if any of you, anyone who is connected in any way to the electronic culture is being spied on, or can be. If you have a cell phone, the National Security Agency has, they may not bother, but in principle they have access to where you are, who you're talking to, what you say. It's even true if your cell phone's off. If you have a computer, the same thing is true. The Snowden revelations demonstrate that if computers, any electronic equipment that's made in the United States, computers, routers, network materials, go to the National Security Agency so they can install equipment into them, which provides access to every keystroke that you make, everything you're doing. And presumably China does the same thing to the extent that they can. Doubtless they can't do it on the scale of the United States, which has enormous capacities. Now, this is a system of surveillance and control which is beyond anything that anyone has ever dreamt of, either anything that was actually realized, like, say, the East German Stasi, or anything that was dreamt of by dystopian novelists like George Orwell and others. It's pretty phenomenal. And how do you defend yourself against it? By eliminating it. You have to eliminate it. If it's going on, there's no way to defend yourself against it. And that's not an impossibility. In the U.S. Congress, they came very close to a vote to ban, to end all funding for the National Security Agency. They lost the vote. It's expanded. But that's not impossible. It depends on the amount of popular opposition. That's true in Europe. That's true in the United States. That's true in countries with less influence in the world. But it's not going to happen by itself. Like anything else, if you just decide to say, I don't like it, nothing's going to stop. But we have plenty of opportunities for overcoming this real crime. It's a major crime. Actually, it is technically a crime. In the United States, it's an explicit violation of the Constitution. Explicit. You take a look at use your internet. Get back to the first question and take a look at the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. It's one of the initial parts of the Constitution. It bans what's called unreasonable search and seizure. It guarantees the privacy of persons, their homes, their papers, and their effects, anything they own. The reason that was put in was because this is right after the American Revolution. And one of the things that sparked the revolution was the insistence of the British imperial masters that they had a right to interfere with individual privacy. that led to confrontations, armed confrontations, in fact, helped set the revolution off. And this principle was instantly introduced into the Constitution. At that time, the tyrant were the British rulers. Today, the tyrant is President Obama and the American government. So the government lawyers, of course, will try to argue that it's not illegal. That's the job of lawyers, whatever crime is being committed. But there's just no way to make these surveillance activities consistent with the clear and explicit wording of the Constitution. So it is technically criminal. The whole government should be, if laws really applied, they'd all be brought to justice for this. Of course, laws don't apply to the powerful. It's another story. But they should, and the public can make it happen, but only by direct activism, no other way.
Let me follow up this question, because it's great what you say about the rule of law in the United States, but do you think can the world of power today allow itself a luxus of banning the espionage, intelligence, following the citizens of its own country and the foreign countries? Because if the USA stop this, I'm quite sure that other powers in the world will not do that. So isn't it a security risk for the U.S. to stop this? Not that I agree with these practices, but on a realistic tone, Russia, China, and other countries will never do that.
Well, the notion security is used as if we understand it. Here's a contribution that philosophers could make. There's a standard line in a belief in international relations theory and public commentary and so on, that the main goal of governments is to achieve security. But two questions are never asked. Security for whom? And security against whom? Okay, it's worth thinking about those things. One thing you can... If you look at the record, it shows quite clearly that governments, any system of power, whether it's a government or a corporation or whatever it may be, is interested in security for itself. They're interested in security for state power, and they're interested in security against their enemies. But a primary enemy is always the domestic population. That's shown over and over. So, I don't know, just take one recent event. The United States recently joined in a request to the International Criminal Court to try Syrian leaders for the crimes that they're committing. But there was a proviso. They cannot inquire into crimes of Israel, and they cannot inquire into crimes of the United States. Actually, the second condition is redundant because there's legislation in the United States which grants to the president the right to use force to rescue, that's the term, any American who's brought to The Hague for trial. It's sometimes called the Netherlands Invasion Act. The U.S. government is self-immunized against international law. This is one of many examples. Well, that's an illustration of, it's an interesting topic, no time to go into it, but an interesting one. That's an illustration of how, one of many, of how states are interested in their own security. And what about the enemies, like the domestic population? Well, yeah, they're not concerned with their security. In fact, if you want to investigate how state is quite an interesting record, but if you look at the actual record of state policy, it constantly subjects the general population to extreme dangers in the interest of protecting state security. The whole history of nuclear weapons illustrates this quite dramatically. To take an even more obvious example, right now there's a major threat to the security of populations, environmental catastrophe, huge threat. How are powerful states reacting? By increasing the threat. I'll give you the details if you like. You're probably familiar with them. Security of their own population is a very marginal concern for states. Security for themselves is a concern. Security for concentrations of private power is a concern. Plenty of illustrations of that. Right now, for example, there's two huge trade agreements being negotiated, the Trans-Pacific and Transatlantic, enormous efforts at international economic arrangements. Notice that these are being conducted in secret. The domestic population, which is an enemy, is not allowed to know about it. It's not completely in secret. It's not secret from the hundreds of corporate lobbyists and lawyers who are actually writing the these agreements. They know about it. But it's, and if you look at the agreements, they have almost nothing to do with trade. They certainly have nothing at all to do with free trade. They have to do with investor rights. That's an example of the one of many of the ways in which states preserve the security of the 1% you were talking about, concentrations of private economic power. It's not a big surprise because it's those concentrations that mostly make the laws and determine policy. So naturally, they're concerned with their own security, but not security of populations. Now, let's go back to the question of whether, suppose that in the United States, we were capable of preventing the National Security Agency from following you around with your cell phone, say, and storing the information about who you talk to, where you are, and so on. How would your security be harmed if that was stopped? I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with the Russians and the Chinese. Of course, we don't want them to do it either, but they're probably incapable of it. We don't want anyone to do it. We don't want the Czech government to do it. But no person's security is harmed if the United States, you know, the dinosaur in the room, stops doing it. There just isn't an issue. I mean, there's another question. Should governments conduct intelligence about other states? Well, that's a separate question. So should Russia, should Iran, let's say, try to figure out what the United States and Israel are trying to do? Yeah, they have every reason to do that. After all, the United States and Israel are violating international law every day by stating that all options are open with regard to Iran. That is a meaning. That means that they're daily threatening Iran with war and, in fact, even nuclear war. That's what all options are open means. Take a look at the United Nations Charter, which is the foundation of modern international law. Article 2 bans the threat or use of force in international affairs. So they are violating it daily. And therefore, Iran certainly has a right to try to figure out what they're doing. And you can think of other cases where states that are under attack, say, or threat of attack, have a right to carry out intelligence efforts. There's one striking case that it's quite real, in fact, right now, as you may know or should know. For 50 years, the United States has been attacking Cuba. Large-scale terrorist war, not small. Large-scale terrorist war, economic embargo, economic strangulation. Just a couple of days ago, the U.S. Justice Department slammed a French bank with a huge fine, maybe $10 billion, because they claim that the French bank is violating U.S. sanctions against Cuba. It's one of the charges. What's the justification for those sanctions? None. Just part of an effort to undermine and destroy Cuba. the Cubans have, this also involves terror attacks, direct terror attacks. A couple of years ago, the Cuban intelligence infiltrated Florida. These come from Florida, the terror attacks. They infiltrated the Florida exile community to try to determine what kind of terror attacks were being planned. And they got a lot of information. They managed to infiltrate it. The Cuban government invited the FBI, the U.S. National Political Police, to Havana to present them with the information about terror attacks being planned against Cuba on U.S. territory, which is, of course, a crime in the United States. How did the U.S. government react? By arresting the people who infiltrated and presented them with the information. Some of them are in jail, maybe for life, long jail sentences. You probably don't know about this because the Western propaganda system carefully protects people from knowing about your own crimes. You've got to know about the crimes of enemies, but your own, it's best not to know about. It's part of the protection of state power from the domestic population. This is not a hypothetical case. This is an actual one. So sure, there are cases, and I think it was quite legitimate for the Cuban government to try to detect and discover terrorist activities on U.S. soil and to present the information to the American government. I think that's quite legitimate. So there are cases, I'm sure you can think of others, where intelligence activities could be legitimate. But activities like a violation of the U.S. Constitution, and generalizing it globally, say, to determining what you are doing every time you walk across the street with your cell phone, I don't think that's legitimate. And if it was stopped, nobody would be harmed.
Thank you.
Maybe I would try to follow with the question which also is associated with technology and awareness of all these things you are, and possibility of awareness of these things you are talking about. The conception of literacy as something which gives one to connect with society, to read and write, to see like below the lines also, to interpret, was for a long time connected mainly with writing and reading. Technology brings complexity which needs much higher kind of also complexity in terms of literacy to be able to be competent to understand all the layers which technology like brings, and to be aware of all the options. For example, also these kind of examples that the mobile phone is not only the mobile phone, but it's part of some network with many, many other functions. Do you see some special role of education in getting this kind of new literacy for this kind of world? Because in education there is a high value of, let's say, critical thought derived from critical thought of, let's say, past ages, but maybe there is something new coming.
Well, first of all, I think we ought to be clear about the facts. Most of you, judging by your ages, know a lot more about this than I do. But my impression is that the new technology is bringing about illiteracy, not literacy. I can see it directly with, I get a ton of email, constant flow of email. I noticed a couple of years ago that there's a change in the character of the email. A lot of it is very short. Some of it is so short it actually fits in the subject line. And somebody pointed out to me it's probably Twitter things. These are what this illustrates is something much more general that's going on among especially younger people than younger means a lot of people from my point of view. There's a tendency towards abbreviation. Like my grandchildren, when they write a letter, it's texting. you know, just get a couple of symbols on the... I notice my own students, they don't read as much as they used to. I mean, I used to, years ago, if I made, say, literary references in class, students usually know what it is. And now, much less. Actually, one of the gurus of the new technology, I've forgotten his name, said recently that with contemporary advances, we don't need things like War and Peace or Proust any longer. We can do it very briefly, you know. This is something that I think is, it's already happening. It's even being studied. There are some studies of literacy among college students over a longer period, and it is reducing. There's much less reading of, independent reading of, say, literature, and much more focus on things you can do very quickly and briefly and so on. There's even some studies, preliminary studies, by cognitive neuroscientists, which may indicate that there are neurological changes taking place as an effect of the reduction of the rapid stimulation and the kind of stimulus hunger that comes with it, and the restriction on attention spans that come from the new technology. I think it's a double-edged sword, in other words. The new technology does offer the possibility of achieving greater thought and understanding, but it also can reduce it. I don't know about you, but if I read something on, say, Kindle, it's very different from reading it in a book. You read it in a book, you think about it, you go back to the earlier page, you know, you pay attention to it. If you're reading it on Kindle, you're just trying to get it. It goes through your head so fast, you don't remember what was in there. You know, I think that's a kind of a dangerous phenomenon. As far as what education can do, I think it should try to cultivate the values of thought and reflection. It doesn't matter how fast you read. There's no advantage to reading fast. You have to read thoughtfully and carefully, and that's the way students should be induced to look at the intellectual, artistic, other treasures of the world. But I think they may have to combat the new technology.
Your turn.
All right. Let's go to the big issue, and that is anarchism. You call yourself an anarchist or anarcho-syndicalist, to be precise. So my question, or actually I would like to pose more questions on this topic, but the first question is very simple. But I guess the answer should be very complex. How would an anarchist society would look like? How would an anarchist society would look like? Sorry. And second question: how to communicate anarchist ideas? Because my experience is, and I'm not anarchist myself, but kind of sympathizer. My experience is that people, when you say the word anarchy, people imagine a lack of order. People imagine lack of security, something like the Hobbesian state of nature, the war of all against all, and so on. And I think that the general idea of anarchism in the general public is very much influenced by this misconception. So how to communicate anarchist ideas?
The first thing to do is to overcome the misconceptions, to explain what you mean by anarchism. Now, it's a pretty broad concept. Like, in general, the concepts of political discourse are very far from precise. I mean, to try to explain what liberal means or capitalism means or any term you pick, they're used in highly varied and complex and often contradictory ways, and anarchism is no exception. But I think if you try to find a sort of core themes running through anarchist thought and action, there are some. Basically, it seems to me one should think of anarchism as not a specific set of doctrines, but just a kind of a tendency in human thought and action, which tries to detect and discover structures of authority, domination, and hierarchy, and there are plenty of them, and to challenge them. Ask them to demonstrate their legitimacy, recognizing that they are not self-justifying. They have a burden of justification. That's true all across the spectrum of human life, from patriarchal families to imperial systems and everything in between. Wherever you find a structure of domination, hierarchy, somebody giving orders, somebody taking them, whatever it may be, you have to ask, is that legitimate? You cannot assume that it, you shouldn't assume it is legitimate because it's been like that. That's not a justification. You have to ask, is it legitimate? When you do, you generally find that it can't be justified. There are cases, you can think of cases where you can make up a justification, but try it, it's pretty hard. Most of the time, the justification is the way power is distributed. That's not a justification. And anarchism is the effort to discover such systems when they can't justify themselves, to dismantle them and to move towards greater freedom, justice, opportunity, individual creativity, cooperative activity, and so on. It's just a tendency in history. And I don't think it's hard to communicate to people. I think they take it for granted if it's brought to their attention. And you see it. For example, take one of the major achievements of the last 50 years in many societies, the United States, many others, I'm sure here, has been women's expansion of women's rights. It's changed enormously. And how did it happen? Well, as soon as the structures of oppression were identified, they kind of disappeared, which is not instantly, of course. There's resistance, still plenty of resistance. But the powers, there's a nice, it's a general truth that power prefers darkness. If it's exposed to the light, it erodes. If people can see it, it erodes. And this happens all through history. Where does it lead? So what would the final goal be? I don't think anyone is smart enough to say that, to say what it would be. This is a constant, ongoing effort to try to expand the realm of justice, freedom, independence, breakdown of authority, and so on. And I don't see it should have any limits. You can think of all kind of concrete cases. So, for example, just think of the forms of authority and domination that exist in our societies. One of the dominant ones is wage labor. If you go back to the early days of the Industrial Revolution in England and the United States and other countries, people who were being driven into the industrial system bitterly condemned it. In the United States in the mid-19th century, when the Industrial Revolution was beginning, working people described wage labor as equivalent to slavery. The only difference was that wage labor is supposed to be temporary, whereas slavery is permanent. Actually, that was such a widespread idea that it was a slogan of the Republican Party. Abraham Lincoln accepted it. That's when Northern workers went to war in the Civil War. That was one of their slogans. Want to eliminate chattel slavery, you know, literal slavery, and wage, what they called wage slavery. No influence of Marx or European radicalism. This just came straight out of popular understanding, the popular understanding of free, independent people who felt their rights are being taken away by being forced into a system where they have to sell themselves to survive. I mean, they understood. You read their... They had their own... This is the period of the freest press in American history, maybe any history. There's working-class press, what were called factory girls, young women taken from the farms and forced into the textile mills, had their own journals. It's very rich literature. And one of the themes was that if you sell what you produce for a price, like you're an independent crafts person, you make something and you sell it, you're selling what you produced. If you work for a wage, you're selling yourself. You're losing your freedom. You're the only thing that you're selling is yourself. You're losing your freedom, your dignity, your independence, your worth as a person. Well, you know, over the century, over the year, century and a half, this has kind of been instilled into people's heads, and the intuitive understanding of the absolute injustice of this relationship has been kind of suppressed. But I think it's right below the surface. I don't think it takes much for people to recover the understanding that was second nature a century and a half ago. Maybe some work, but that's the kind of thing that organizers and activists ought to be doing. And that's a kind of oppression and domination I think should be eliminated. And we know how to do it. It should be eliminated by enterprises that are managed and run by their participants. Not a particularly obscure or even utopian concept. It happens in many cases. For example, in Spain, Basque Country, there's a huge conglomerate, Mondragon, which is more or less run on these principles, not quite, but something like it. It's owned by the participants. They select their own managers. They don't manage it themselves, and they're under recallable and so on and so forth. That's a step towards overcoming the deep oppression of the wage labor system. In the United States, in the old industrial regions, so-called Rust Belt, where the factories have been abandoned and so on, there's a spontaneous spread of worker-owned and worker-managed enterprises, not huge ones, but pretty substantial ones. In fact, they're now one of the more progressive unions. The United Steelworkers is right now involved in discussions with Mondragon in the Basque Country to try to integrate their activities. These things come very naturally to people. It seems perfectly obvious thing to do. And I don't think there's difficulty in communicating it once people are freed from the oppression that comes from just reflexively adopting the customs and conventions in which you survive. Actually, it's rather similar to the women's movement in this respect. So, for example, if you'd ask my grandmother whether she was oppressed, she wouldn't have understood what you're talking about. That's like asking, does she breathe? You know, if you ask my mother whether she was oppressed, she knew it and she resented it, but she thought there's nothing you can do about it. My daughter is totally different. They won't even bother answering it. Those are changes. Those are changes that have taken place just through exposing power to the sunlight and seeing it evaporate. And I think this can happen in many domains. So what would an anarchist society look like? Well, you know, the final result, I don't expect a final result. Human life is too complicated, but the you can see steps towards more freedom, more elimination of illegitimate structures of authority, and where it goes is for people to make their own decisions about.
Hopefully, it would be like you describe it, but I still have a little doubt, and that is, isn't it too demanding? You know, it's easier to be led by authority, by an authority. I'm myself a sort of activist, and sometimes I regret it all the time, but it's terribly time-consuming. It costs me a lot of energy. The outcome is very uncertain. It's not very rewarding, or not all the time. It's easier to be led by authorities. So isn't the idea too much demanding?
That's basically an argument for slavery. The optimal, you know, I mean, the ultimate position in which you don't have to make any decisions at all is if the master just tells you what to do in the morning, you go do it. Wage labor is somewhere in between. It's, my grandmother's oppression was somewhere in between. It's true that freedom creates burdens. You have to make choices and decisions. But a burden isn't really the right word. That makes you a person's more alive, has greater opportunities for use of their own independent faculties. You can develop your faculties, you can apply them. Yeah, it does require choices and takes time, but that's all to the good. You teach in a university, right? Well, universities are about as close as exists in the modern world to self-managed societies. There is an administrative structure. There's the people who run it, and the state authorities and so on. But deans, we've got to get rid of them. But but you go to a university faculty, the actual faculty, say the philosophy department or the chemistry department, pretty much they make their own decisions about what they're going to do, what they're going to work on, when you're going to work, when you're not going to work, who you work with, what courses you teach, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's not an anarchist society, but it comes about as close as anything in the modern world. And people choose it and prefer it. It just gives you lots of freedom that you don't have in other professions. That's one of the reasons why people quite commonly will take a academic position instead of working in the business world at a much higher salary, but much less freedom. Freedom itself is a remarkable value.
Just a small remark. There were plenty of doctrines, ideologies, and then regimes which were promising anarchical society or a society where the oppressors are gone. Well, actually, they brought more oppression and more suffering. And you can go far back in the history. So,
which do you have in mind?
French Revolution, for instance.
Well, the French Revolution didn't promise anarchy.
Well, that's true. They didn't promise anarchy, but they brought the society in anarchy for a while, and a number of people suffered.
Not anarchy. They did overthrow a system of oppression, like the king, the nobility, the church, and a lot of that was permanent. But it quickly instituted a system of extreme oppression, very quickly. Nevertheless, there were gains, and the gains are permanent. Through the rest of French and, in fact, world history, a lot was built on the basis of the achievements that were made, even though they were beaten back.
Well, we have some earlier examples, like the Soviet regime, which was promising. I'm not saying that it was an anarchy, but it was promising something better.
I think that's a mistake. The If you take a look back to the early part of the 20th century, early 1900s, the Marxist left was bitterly condemning Lenin because of his authoritarian tendencies. In fact, even people like Trotsky, who later cooperated with him, were pointing out that Lenin's conception, this is before the 1905 revolution even, Lenin's conception was that the Communist Party should rule over the proletariat, the Central Committee should rule over the Communist Party, and the maximal leader, Lenin, should rule over the Central Committee. And in fact, about as soon as the Bolshevik takeover took place in October 1917, that's exactly what happened. If you take a look at I think the history is, in my view, misunderstood. Now, there was a period from April 1917 until October 1917, right in that period. If you read Lenin's writings there, they do have a kind of a libertarian anarchist flavor. But it was not true before, and it certainly wasn't true after. And I think a kind of cynical but probably accurate interpretation of this is that he was a politician. He was trying to appeal to the revolutionary fervor of the 1917 revolution. So he was taking the positions and the attitudes of the general public and was trying to present himself as the spokesman for them. Once he took power, it was back to the earlier positions, highly authoritarian. And in fact, Lenin, you know, in his justification, he had a reason. He had a, you know, there was a justification for it. It wasn't just personal power. I mean, he was an orthodox Marxist, and there was a kind of a Marxist orthodoxy, which Marx didn't believe in. But Marx and Marxism are two different things. There was a Marxist orthodoxy, which held that the proletariat has to be the leading force in bringing about a communist revolution. Now, Lenin understood that in Russia was a backward, mostly peasant society. There wasn't a proletariat which could be a leading force. And if you look at Lenin's view at the time, it was that the revolution would take place in Germany, the most advanced industrial society, and Russia would be a kind of a backwater. And it would sort of have to be drawn along in the world revolution. Well, there was a kind of an effort, the Spartacist uprising in 1919, which quickly crushed, and that was the end of Germany as the leading force in, you know, the global revolution he was thinking about. And Lenin immediately undertook kind of a state capitalist policies, new economic policy. And the idea was to drive Russia, which from his point of view was a backward peasant society, to drive it to industrialization. And then when you get an industrial proletariat, you know, iron laws of history and all that, they'll carry out the revolution. Marx, incidentally, didn't believe that. And Marx himself was quite impressed by the revolutionary potential of the Russian peasantry. He was, in his last years, you look at his manuscripts, he was spending a lot of time on the detailed analyses that were presented by the Narodniks of the Russian peasantry, and he was pretty impressed by them and felt that there was a real revolutionary potential there. But that was not the view of the urban Marxists, either the Bolsheviks or the Social Democrats. And they kind of suppressed that work of his. It wasn't really discovered until considerably later. But I think that was kind of the logic of it. So there was never an effort, in my view, in the part of the this is not the Soviet Union, this is Russia, to have it lead a socialist, communist, little even socialist revolution. I think that's a misunderstanding. Of course, that was the world's two propaganda systems insist that the Soviet Union was socialist. The West insists on it in order to undermine socialism. The East insisted on it to try to gain what they could from the moral appeal of socialism. And when the world's two propaganda systems, you know, the huge one in the West and the small one in the East, when they agree on something, it tends to be kind of persuasive. But I think it's just flat wrong on both cases and kind of opportunistic in both sides.
Thank you. Pete, your turn. Question of you.
Maybe I'll synthesize a few questions also in a reaction. For just to turn our to turn your attention to mechanisms, how it happens that the freedom is getting lost. For example, 25 years ago, here we had the revolution where the general ethos and energy of the revolution was driven by the idea of freedom. And then there was a response or several responses how to achieve it, how to make the freedom working like every day on everyday basis.
What specifically are you thinking of?
And one of the responses was the free market, for example. Free market, and from free market you go to commodification of many human activities. We see, for example, commodification of media, commodification of education, and it has big impact for society. However, it looks on the ground not so serious as it is.
Well, let's take the concept of the free market. The free market is a system that does exist. It's imposed on the weak. The strong never permit it. The United States, Britain, Germany, they don't have free markets. Take your cell phone again and have a look at it and ask yourself where the technology that's built into that cell phone came from. It's an interesting exercise. Overwhelmingly, it came from the state sector. Places like where I work, MIT, which is technically a private institution, but almost totally state-funded. That's where computers, the Internet, microelectronics, lasers, pharmaceuticals, that's where it's all developed. Almost the entire IT revolution, the information technology revolution, overwhelmingly it comes out of the state sector. For decades, I mean, take computers. They entered the market. You could sell personal computers. Apple was the first one to be able to sell computers. That was 1977. And that's about 30 years after the major research and development and investment had been done mostly in the state sector. The Internet was being developed from around 1960, was finally handed over to private enterprise in 1995, 35 years later. And that's true across the board. Like if you have a GPS in your hand device, whatever it is, that's an application of the U.S. Navy Navistar system that was developed decades earlier. And that goes way back in history. The American mass production system, which kind of amazed the world in the mid-19th century, was mostly developed in government armories. And there's a reason for this. When things are done in the state sector, cost and risk don't matter because the population is paying for it, taxpayers paying for it. So you can undertake risky, costly efforts. Finally, if anything comes out of them, they're handed over to the private sector for profit. Now, this is an exaggeration. It's not 100% like this, but that's the core way in which the economy works. Goes way back to the early days of British industrialization in the 18th century. The record very clearly shows that states that have violated what are called sound economic principles are the ones that have prospered. Just to give you an illustration, when the American colonies were liberated from England, they got advice from the best British economists. Adam Smith, for example, advised the colonies on the policies that they should follow. And his advice was almost the same as what the IMF told Eastern Europe in 1990 and what the West tells the Third World, almost the same. You should have market principles. You should, he told the colonies, you should concentrate on what you're good at, what later was called your comparative advantage. You should produce cotton and primary products and fish and fur. Don't produce manufacturing goods because the British manufacturing goods are much better. So import British manufacturers, produce primary products. Certainly don't try to monopolize your primary products. Remember, the main primary product then was cotton. Cotton was like the oil of the early Industrial Revolution. So he said, don't try to monopolize cotton, just keep to market principles, produce primary products, import superior British goods, and then everyone will be better off. Now, that's what's called sound economics, right up to the present moment. Well, the colonies were liberated. They didn't have to follow sound economics. So they violated every principle. Well, they immediately turned to very high protective tariffs to block superior British manufacturers. A lot of state initiative was put into developing industry, at first textiles, later steel, up till today with computers and the internet. That became a rich, powerful country. Incidentally, that's just what Britain had done before. That's what Germany did later. That's what France did. That's what Japan did. These are the countries that prospered, not by the free market. Now, the free market is imposed, does exist in the colonies, like the British imposed a free market system on India. It was a colony. They ran it. India was one of the was along with China, was the most advanced a commercial and industrial center of the world in the 17th century. Now, after a couple of years of British imperialism and the market system was a wreck, you know, that's exactly what happened in Eastern Europe. The imposition of market systems in Eastern Europe destroyed the economies. Ukraine, for example, I think was maybe the richest part of Eastern Europe back in 1990. And now it's a basket case. In Russia in the 1990s, the economy was reduced by, I think, about 50%. The number of people who died in Russia in the 1990s, nobody knows the exact numbers, but it was certainly in the millions. In fact, it was almost on a par with Stalin's purges. That's the imposition of market principles. You see it all over the world. So I think we should, you know, the rich and the powerful protect themselves from markets. Dramatically, I'll give you the most dramatic example from today's economy. Today's economy, Western economies, are largely financialized. They're based on financial institutions. So in the United States, I think maybe 40% of corporate profits are, you know, banks and other financial institutions. There was recently a study by the International Monetary Fund of the six major American banks, the biggest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, Goldman Sachs, and so on. And they asked a simple question. Where do their profits come from? Turns out their profits come almost entirely from a government insurance policy. There's a policy which is called too big to fail. That amounts to a government insurance policy. That tells the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase that you can make risky investments and transactions, which will be profitable. And if it crashes, don't worry about it because the taxpayer will bail you out. And it's not just the bailouts. That's a small part of it. It's access to cheap credit, better credit ratings, all sorts of devices. I mean, the business press estimated the taxpayer gift to the big banks at over $80 billion a year. That's called a market. It's got nothing to do with markets. That's class warfare. That's powerful systems using their power to extort wealth out of the public so they can prosper. And that's pretty much the, it's the same with these trade agreements, like the transit. We don't know the details because they're secret, but the parts that have leaked out are highly protectionist and designed to increase to monopoly pricing rights, you know, like excessive profits for pharmaceuticals. So I think we should be very cautious about thinking about terms like free market. I mean, there are, in fact, you know, if you just think about it, the things that we are not taught not to think about are pretty remarkable. Like there's a huge industry in the West here too, huge industry devoted to undermining markets. It's called the public, the advertising industry. If you've ever taken an economics course, you learn that markets are based on informed consumers making rational choices. All of economic theory is based on that. Turn on the television set and take a look at an ad. Is it trying to create an informed consumer making a rational choice? No, of course not. You know, it's trying to undermine markets because business doesn't want markets. They want power. You know? Another principle of markets is that, say, if you make an investment, you decide to invest in some small company that's trying some risky thing, and you keep investing in it for decades, and finally something comes out. In a market system, you'd get the profit, not in our society. The way it works in our society is that the taxpayer makes the investment for decades, like computers, internet, etc. And when something profitable comes out, it doesn't go back to the taxpayer. It goes to Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or somebody like that. It's got nothing to do with markets. You know, it has to do with power. And again, there are places where market systems are imposed, like the Third World or like Eastern Europe after 1990. But that has nothing to do with freedom.
Professor Chomsky, you have touched the topic of Russia, and may I ask you about your current view on the situation in Ukraine, Russia, Crimea, and reaction of the U.S. government or EU towards the situation there?
Well, the invasion and annexation of Crimea is in violation of international law. It's in violation of explicit treaties to which Russia was a party to observe the borders of Ukraine, no doubt about that. It's not the only such case in the world. There are much worse cases. We don't talk about them because they're our crimes, but they exist. So think about them. Take, for example, the just to take the most obvious, which would be on the front pages if there was anything like a free press. Take, say, the U.S. takeover of eastern Cuba. Okay, it was taken at the point of a gun. There's a treaty, but it was under military occupation. So Cuba was forced to hand over eastern Cuba to the United States. It's what we call Guantanamo. It's a big part of southeastern Cuba. Includes Cuba's major port and any real hope they have for trade and development. The U.S. has held it for over a century. When Cuba got its independence in 1959, they asked to have it back. U.S. refuses. For over 50 years now, the U.S. has refused Cuban efforts to get that part of their territory back. The U.S. has no justification for this, no strategic interest, no historical connections, nothing except one thing. It helps, contributes to the U.S. policy of undermining Cuba's hope for independent development. That's it. It's part of the policy of economic warfare, of terrorist activity, and so on. Otherwise, nothing. I mean, the Russian actions in Crimea are criminal, but they have a much stronger case than the U.S. has in eastern Cuba. And there's other cases. Take, say, Israel. Israel has annexed the Syrian Golan Heights. That's in explicit violation of Security Council orders, not only in violation of international law, but in violation of explicit orders of the Security Council, ordering them not to do it. Take what's called Jerusalem. Jerusalem today has almost nothing to do with anything that was ever Jerusalem. It's about five times as big as historic Jerusalem. Israel's annexed it in violation of explicit Security Council orders. Take what Israel's doing in the West Bank. The settlement and infrastructure developments, all in violation of international law. It's not debatable. I mean, the Security Council, the International Court of Justice have all ruled on it. They can do it because the United States backs it. And that's the way power works in the world. So there's that. And we can continue the Turkish occupation of northern Cyprus. There's many other cases. So sure, it's a criminal act. Should be condemned in the context of recognition of what's going on. First of all, in comparison with others that we're responsible for, and also because Russia does have claims, unlike the U.S., say, in eastern Cuba. I'm sure you know the background. Khrushchev just handed Crimea over to Ukraine in 1954. He never asked the population, and the population was not in favor of it. There were referenda much earlier, early 90s, which came out about the same as the recent referendum. Russia's only warm water port is in Crimea. It's their main naval base. It's got long historic connections and so on. So it's a criminal act, but there are arguments for it, unlike, say, the U.S. and Cuba. Furthermore, there's a history. If you take a look at what's the EU, U.S., and Russian actions now, there's, if you read the press or you listen to government pronouncements, there's a lot of condemnation of the fact that Russia is carrying out military maneuvers near the border of Ukraine, but inside Russia. At the same time, the U.S. is carrying out military maneuvers in Poland and the Baltic states, right? That would be analogous to Russia carrying out military maneuvers in Mexico and Canada. Okay, but we don't condemn that. And there's a principle. The principle is we own the world. And if any country is doing something, even in its own territory, that we don't like, that's illegitimate. But if we're doing something anywhere in the world, it's legitimate. That's kind of a fundamental imperial principle accepted in much of the West without any question. And there's also a history that's not obscure. Right after the Berlin Wall fell, 1990, Mikhail Gorbachev made a pretty astonishing offer. He offered to allow Germany to be unified and to join a hostile military alliance, NATO. You should take a look at the history of the preceding century, and you can see what that was. I mean, I don't have to tell you, it's obvious. There was a quid pro quo. This is the U.S. government, that's President Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, they agreed not to let NATO move, the phrase was, 1 inch to the east, meaning to East Germany. They pledged that NATO would not move to East Germany. That was the quid pro quo. Immediately, NATO moved to East Germany. Gorbachev was outraged, and the U.S. government simply informed him, it's not on paper, it was only a gentleman's agreement, and if you're dumb enough to accept our word for something, it's your problem. So then Clinton came in right afterwards and extended NATO further to the east, all around the border of Russia. It's a military alliance, hostile military alliance. It's analogous to the Warsaw Pact taking over Mexico and Canada. It's kind of would be an analog, unthinkable. We'd have a nuclear war tomorrow, before, you know, instantly. But this is considered, and the Ukraine issue is related to that. If NATO were to extend further into Ukraine, that would be an enormous security threat. I mean, Russia's already very vulnerable, and unlike the United States, and surrounded by hostile powers, in fact, on all sides. And this would be a real serious security threat. So there are issues going way back. So going back to your point, yes, Crimea is a criminal act, but it's a lot more complex than that.
We should move on, and last two questions. So first, Martin.
Okay, thanks. Up to this point, we were talking about humans, but I think we could utter a few words also about other beings, those without universal grammar. And I would like to know your opinion on animal rights, and then your opinion on veganism. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, over the past centuries, the kind of domain of rights has been expanded. So, like, if you go back 800 years to Magna Carta, the kind of foundation of Anglo-American, now Western law, it granted something called presumption of innocence. You're innocent unless proven guilty in a fair trial by a jury of peers. Now, that, incidentally, that right has completely disappeared. Today, guilty means that Tuesday morning, Obama decided to kill you. That's what guilty means today. That's the drone terror campaign. But there was such a principle, presumption of innocence. But it was for free, privileged men. In fact, barons, you know. Over the centuries, it expanded. Not totally, but it did expand considerably. Okay, you take, say, the United States. In the United States Constitution, it's there, but it meant free men with a certain amount of property. Obviously, it didn't mean slaves. It didn't mean Native Americans. It didn't mean women. They were not. In fact, women under the U.S. took over British common law under which women were property. They weren't persons. So a woman is the property of her father. That's properties handed over to her husband. In fact, that lasted until 1975, not that long ago. In 1975, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that women have a right to serve on federal juries. That means to be peers. To be a peer means to be a person. So it took a long time, but expanded. It's not perfect, but it expanded. And rights have extended in other ways, like slavery is outlawed and so on. And that's also true of animal rights. There's been an expansion of the concern for animal rights. So take, say, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, two major universities, Harvard and MIT. 50 years ago, the labs were carrying out experiments with animals that you cannot carry out today. They violate federal law, local law, and even university laws. All right, that's an expansion of the domain of animal rights. At the same time, there's severe regression, huge regression. You take a look at species extinction today. Species extinction today is at the level of 65 million years ago when an asteroid hit the Earth and ended the age of the dinosaurs. Massive extinction took place. That kind of opened the way for mammals, ultimately us. Species extinction now is at the same level, except we're the asteroid. That's an attack on animal rights, which is just colossal. You know, we're wiping out species at the rate of 65 million years ago when an asteroid hit. You can't imagine a more extreme violation of the rights of animals, of species. And we don't even know if that's, not enough is known to know if that's the actual number. It could be much higher. because we can identify lots of species. So it goes both ways. It's definitely a serious issue, and we ought to think about it. Part of geologists, as a lot of you probably know, break up the history into epochs. Now, there was the Pleistocene, which lasted a couple of million years, up until 10,000 years ago. And then comes the Holocene, that is connected with the human invention of agriculture, which made a big change in, you know, in the general environment. 250 years ago starts a new epoch. It's called the Anthropocene. That's the Industrial Revolution, with really rapid effects on the general environment. You take a look at these numbers and project, and it's not pretty to ask what comes next. But that's what we're doing, and we're racing forward to make it worse. Say, in the United States now, there's a lot of enthusiasm about becoming the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century, 100 years of energy independence, and so on. But what's the world going to look like after another century of exploiting fossil fuels? Well, don't have to leave it to your imagination, but it's not something projected for the future. It's something underway right now with a massive attack on animal rights, in fact, massacres. And we're next, not far.
Sorry, and what about veganism? What do you think about this attitude? Is it effective, or can it help?
Well, you know, I think you can give an argument for it, but there's costs associated with it. I mean, it takes time, effort, planning, so there are costs. And you could say the same about turning the lights on in the evening. I mean, we all do it, but there are costs. In fact, that's one of the things that's contributing to the massacre of animals. So we live in a world in which we make choices and they have costs. And you have to then make decisions about which ones are the right ones for you. What's the opportunity cost for doing something? So should you live in the dark, say? And should you walk instead of taking a bus? I mean, questions arise all the time. Veganism, I think, is like that.
Thank you. One last question, if I may ask you.
Okay, I will take the question coming from universities are named after the word universality. What is the situation today? Can you see it as a universality? Is it still applicable?
Universality?
Yes.
Well, I think there are some simple universal principles which we all sort of, which are kind of interesting if you think about them. They're doubly, the most interesting ones are the ones that are doubly universal. They're universal in that we all accept them, and they're universal in that we all violate them. So we accept them in principle, but we violate them in practice. So take the most elementary one, the golden rule. You know, apply to yourself the same standards you apply to others, version of it. If you ask, do we accept it verbally? Yeah. Do we live by it? Not for a minute. Take a look at the way we, all the things we've been talking about. Do we apply to ourselves the standards we apply to our enemies, say Russia today or Iran or whatever? We don't have to go into it. We don't begin to apply these standards to ourselves. We're immune to the standards we apply to enemies. So we preach the universal principles. But we universally violate them, not everybody, of course, but the systems that actually function in the world do. And we can go on with that. I think there's plenty of examples like that. I know there was once a collection of essays by a bunch of good philosophers on work of mine, and one of the contributors complained that the only ism I seem to believe in is truism. And he was basically right. I think truisms have a lot of value. We should pay attention to it.
I'm sure there are plenty more questions which we have in mind and our audience has, but we are running out of time. Professor Chomsky, I wanted to thank you very much
thank you.
For being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
It's a great honor for Palatsky University and I think for the whole Czech Republic. We appreciate your highly controversial issues and views on some problems like politics, and I hope you will enjoy the rest of your stay in the wonderful city of Olomouc. Thank you very much again.
Thank you. Thank you all.